Hey now, welcome to another edition of the Inside BS Show. Today we are talking about bankruptcy. That's right. It is one of my favorite subjects, and I'm not kidding. I love bankruptcy lawyers. For those of you who are not initiated in the practice of law, bankruptcy is it's a tool and it's something that was created to help businesses who need a fresh start. Now, over the years, the complexity of bankruptcy has increased, and we have the perfect person to help us talk about that today. He also has a very specific, I'm going to call it a niche. Let's see what he calls it, in bankruptcy that he's been doing for 28 years. And I want to delve into that a little bit. It is my pleasure, my privilege to welcome Neville Reed to the Inside BS Show. All right, Neville, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about you and your background and why you chose bankruptcy as your preferred practice area.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, David. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm glad to be part of this. I chose bankruptcy because it was an area in which it seemed as though the questions that we were asking were really interesting and riveting. I had started my practice after finishing at Harvard Law School. I started practicing law at Mayer Brown, where I was for 22 years. And I started in the general transactions practice, where we were putting together a lot of deals. And when the first major recession of my practice hit in 1990, a lot of those deals came to a halt and they had to get restructured. And as they were getting restructured, as debt was getting restructured, companies were attempted to be salvaged. I just found the questions that we were asking very interesting. Do you keep the same management team? Can the company be saved? Do you have to sell the company? It was just those are very fascinating questions, and they need a lot of help in our bankruptcy area. So I helped them on it. As I more helped them, the more I liked it. and because of the questions that we were asking and trying to see what could be done to remedy financial distress, I just got really, really sucked in. I also found that the skill sets in bankruptcy are very, very diverse. You have a great opportunity to do both transaction work and litigation work without going into the extremes of either. So in the transactional practice of law, you often get overwhelmed and buried with a lot of documents, a lot of forms. They're great, but I mean, you can become very pigeonholed. And in litigation, you can just get overwhelmed with a lot of discovery, a lot of procedural delays and spending a lot of time doing other things besides getting to the point. I find that in bankruptcy, because everybody has lost so much money already, they're much more interested in getting right to the point, much more interested in getting to a deal, much more interested in getting to a settlement if you have it. Sometimes you got to litigate as necessary to increase your leverage, but everybody's trying to get to some resolution of the problem. And that's one of the things I really love a lot. Great diverse set of skills, draws on diplomacy, equanimity, litigation, ability to do a deal, stand up in court and to make a persuasive case that you come with the best resolution for the distress situation at hand without getting dragged into the extremes.
All right. So Neville, tell us about I'm going to use a word here and you correct me if I'm wrong, the fraternal nature of the bankruptcy bar. It seems like the members of the bankruptcy bar are always running into each other, especially when there's a recession and there are a lot of high profile bankruptcies. Talk about the fraternal nature of the bankruptcy bar.
Yeah, that's a great emphasis, Dave. I got to tell you, bankruptcy lawyers and bankruptcy professionals are really some of the best people I've ever met. I mean, I know it's a little bit cliche-ish. It sounds childish, but it's just absolutely true. It is not unusual that the very person that you're negotiating with on the other side, if they represent the lender and you say represent an investor or the debtor, it is not unusual that you'll have this knockdown, drag out negotiation, but at another time, the roles will be flipped. You'll be on the other side, or they may need to have somebody assist with your particular skill set in a particular situation. And they may, because they respect you, have to call you into a situation. So fraternal is, I think, a very good word for it. A lot of mutual respect, and I don't know why that's a different culture, say, than sort of general litigation or other areas. It may have to do with the fact that the way Congress designed the bankruptcy code, it's all structured to get to a resolution. It is actually, and the judges foster that culture as well, with wanting to make sure that the party they're trying to exhaust all opportunities to resolve a distress situation. That might be self-selective. It could be that people who like that kind of environment go into it, so therefore we all tend to be very similar. But I like to think also that as a result of being in that culture, it kind of rubs off on you, that you see the referral system going on, you see the mutual respect, and I think it's a lot better and more pronounced than I've observed in some other areas of our practice.
So tell us a little bit about let's use an airline example, right? American Airlines files for bankruptcy and there are 150 creditors. Mm-hmm. And explain how it works, a creditors committee, and each person has to have their own representation. That's why you guys are so great about referring each other. Do us a favor and give us the very short course on how something like that works.
Sure. So if it's an 11, then in 11 in our system, unlike in other countries, the presumption is that the debtor can continue to operate their business. And so you're operating in under the supervision of a federal bankruptcy judge. There is an entity from the Justice Department called the United States Trustee Office, and the Office of the United States Trustee, and they are responsible for overseeing the procedural aspects of the bankruptcy case, making sure people have proper notice, that a committee of creditors is formed. Sometimes they have to form more than one committee of creditors, because not all creditors have similar interests. You might have a bank committee, you might have a trade committee. Maybe if there are people who are injured, say, by a particular kind of accident, that you might have to have a personal injury plaintiff type committee. So they'll organize the committees of creditors in a case according to a commonality of interest. And the whole goal of the Chapter 11 case is to get into a plan of reorganization. And the plan of reorganization is like a new contract with your creditors. The old contract, the old relationships go away and you form a new contract, and that goes out. That plan is the culmination of the case will include organization of classes by a similarity of interest. It will also describe what each class is going to get. Are they impaired? That is, are their pre-petition contractual rights being adjusted, or are they being preserved? And to the extent they are impaired, are they being treated fairly? Are the economic rights based on what's left of the bankruptcy estate? Are they being treated fairly? And that plan is accompanied by a disclosure statement, which is analogous to a prospectus. And that disclosure statement describes to the creditors who they are, where you're organized, and what you're going to get. And that is sent out to a vote. And it's the vote is by class, and if it's an impaired class, then it'll be by majority number of claims and two-thirds of dollar amount of claims per class. And then, but that's not the end of it. The plan, if it's approved by the requisite classes, comes back to the court for what's called confirmation, and the judge will decide, does the plan otherwise satisfy the requirements of the bankruptcy code, one of which is it feasible? Is this case going to end up in what they call a Chapter 22, where he confirms a plan, he or she confirms a plan, but then a year later they think they're going to be in bankruptcy again. So, and then the debtor is off and running as a fresh start, as a new entity, and that's in Chapter 11. Chapter 7 is a different, where a trustee is appointed, and I do a lot of those because I've been a bankruptcy trustee since 1994, and that's where you have control over all of the assets of the estate, and in a 7-year, you're liquidating, but often you're looking for an entity to buy the assets if it's a company, as either as a going concern or for as great a price as possible in an orderly liquidation.
So Neville, in an 11, in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, each one of the creditors has to have, or you know, it's not required, but they should have their own counsel, right?
Yeah, that would absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the, it's trap for the unwary. I've heard some judges say, please get, they say to a pro se creditor, please get yourself a bankruptcy lawyer. This is not a familiar territory for you. It has its own set of rules. And I think that's a good thing that judges do, when people think they can kind of manage their own affairs.
And that's one of the reasons why I love this practice area, is this, you know, this giant case can have, you know, 50 lawyers or 100 lawyers, because each creditor needs his or her own lawyer, or each entity needs his or her own lawyer. Now, right. You mentioned the Chapter 7s and being a trustee. Why did you choose to be a trustee? Because not every bankruptcy lawyer becomes a trustee. In fact, very few do. So why did you choose to become a trustee?
Yeah, I chose largely because I saw it as a great opportunity to come in and be both the lawyer and the business person and to do as best you can a degree of economic justice. I love what trustees do. What we as trustees do is we come in like in a Chapter 7 situation and we investigate the debtor and see if there's any hidden assets that creditors can be paid from. But we often find wrongdoing where, say, for example, some insiders of a company may have transferred the business into a different entity beyond the reach of the creditors. And all the creditors of the original entity, they're looking to you, the trustee, to bring about some kind of economic justice, to go after those fraudulent transfers, return the value to the estate, and get the creditors paid. And creditors are a very diverse group. Some people hear creditors, they think, oh, the big multinational corporations, they can take care of themselves. No, in the vast majority of cases, creditors can be an ex-wife who may have helped found the company, and the debtor is a husband, and he may have tried to get the company to a family member or someone else in the family that they're estranged from, to hide the company from the ex-wife who worked with him to build it over years. The creditor could be small business people in your community who really are counting on getting paid and can't afford to have, you know, huge write-offs. Otherwise, they'll just be out of business. They don't have the kind of cushion that the big Microsofts and big companies have. Sometimes creditors are just individuals, somebody who helps somebody in distress and they're not paid back. Or it could be small banks who are counting on the return of that flow of money from the bank of entities in order to make new loans to people who want to buy homes and grow their business. So that's what I did. I want to get in, not just because I like the set of skills that we do and that we utilize in bankruptcy, but I love the extra element where I'm the person making that decision to go after the bad guys, people who've done bad things, and to bring about some economic justice for people who otherwise wouldn't have a skill set to bring about that result.
Okay, now I want to ask you about I don't know how else to put it, the stigma associated with bankruptcy, and I want to get your take, because you've seen everything when it comes to bankruptcy, the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? Should we not have a stigma about bankruptcy? I mean, doesn't bankruptcy exist to let entrepreneurs take a chance to create an economic engine? What's your opinion? Should we have a stigma related to bankruptcy or not?
Well, that's a great, great question. I think culturally as a country, we had a long period of time where we had thought that if you didn't pay your bills, it was like stealing. And as you go further back in history, you have debtor's prison, you know, medieval Europe. So thankfully, those are gone.
Yeah, you can say that again.
So culturally, I don't think it was wrong for people to value repaying, you know, value keeping your promises the way that we did, and we should still do that. I think in the individual situation where you have some people who are irresponsible, they're reckless, they borrow money that they know they shouldn't have. There isn't a stigma, but there is, I think, an unfortunate reality that some people are using bankruptcy to get out of obligations, which had they managed their lives better, they would have been able to pay it. But in the overwhelming majority of cases that I've been involved with as a trustee, particularly Chapter 7, people need the relief. I mean, they're subject to vagaries and exogenous shocks and factors like COVID, a downturn in a particular sector, divorce, illness, lack of health insurance, and a lack of a comprehensive infrastructure of healthcare insurance in our country that still leaves some people out in the cold. So the vast majority of people that I run across, they really need the relief. Stigma is like the last thing on their mind. They got to feed their kids. They got to send their kids to school. They need to wipe out debt so that they can have enough money to pay their essential bills. That's the typical individual debtor. On the corporate side, I think we have a really great system, because our system presumes that the person who's probably most knowledgeable about how to recover the business is the current management itself. That's why the presumption in our system is the current management and the current owners can continue to operate unless they become, unless they show themselves to be hopelessly corrupt, if they're not honest, they don't follow the rules. And then we would get, even in a Chapter 11 case, and I'm doing one now, the creditors and the government say, we have to get a trustee involved in this 11 to replace management, to get the company, to save the company from basically themselves, from management who are doing a poor job. But those are the rare, those are the rare situations. Most companies that go into 11 really should be given that chance to reorganize. And for them, again, it's not, I mean, I think that the stigma may be there, and it certainly is there for some businesses, but they should take confidence in the fact that there have been some, you know, pretty successful people who, and successful companies who've used bankruptcy as a restructuring tool, and are still around to talk about. You talk about the airlines. I mean, so many of the airlines were in Chapter 11, but thank God they're still flying today. And so that, I think that is the case. Now, Dave, you mentioned something about stigma that I think is related to another point that we should cover, which is one of the pieces of advice that I give people when they come to me is, when they're in financial distress and they're saying, hey, I got to file bankruptcy, I very often talk them out of bankruptcy because they have not considered the impact, the potential adverse impact that a bankruptcy filing might have on customer relationships, on cash flow, on their earnings. And their, all their projections may get thrown off when they take into account, hey, major customer relationships might leave me if I'm actually in bankruptcy. So let's look at the, let's diagnose the underlying problem of the business. Maybe it doesn't relate to all your credit. Maybe you just have a really difficult relationship with one principal client who's not paying you. And as a result of they're not paying you, you're not able to pay your landlord, you're not able to pay your bank. Let's look at that relationship, restructure it, and then maybe get into what's called a forbearance, where you're trying to get what I like to say, the benefits of bankruptcy without filing bankruptcy. Get the benefits of bankruptcy without actually filing. And you can do that through all kinds of tools that we have at our disposal. And one of the best things I have seen is where clients take that advice. We utilize the non-bankruptcy tools for their benefit. They stay out of bankruptcy and then they go off and they're able to mushroom and pursue all kinds of other opportunities. And I just have, you know, some nice success stories where that gives me a lot of gratification to see how that actually works.
So I have a question and I want you to take a minute and think about the answer because I have to introduce our sponsors real quick. And here's the question that we're going to come back to. I'd like you to give us advice on how we handle, so if we're in debt and we're getting calls from creditors, how do we handle them? And I also want you, second part of the question, so I don't forget, you can remember it. I want you to explain the superpower that you have as a bankruptcy attorney. I'll get into that part of the question right when we come back. So you're going to answer the first part, and then I'm going to ask you the second part in just 1 minute. Our show today is sponsored by Sandrowski Corporate Advisors. Actually, all of our shows are sponsored by Sandrowski Corporate Advisors. For over 35 years, Sandrowski Corporate Advisors has helped businesses, privately held businesses, and businesses in distress, as well as businesses who are facing litigation. So they've helped litigators with their accounting. Now, here's the thing that Sandrowski does, one of the things that I really like. Sandrowski can help you if you're thinking about selling your business. There's a little used area of the tax code called the qualified small business exemption. Now, if you set up your business in a certain way and you're in a few very specific industries, when you go to sell your business, a portion of the capital gains can be excluded from taxes. Now, the Sandrowski Corporate Advisors folks, they have done this dozens and dozens and dozens of times over the last couple of years. And they were just telling me a story about a firm that they helped save, literally, I'm not joking, $10 million. So imagine what the windfall in profit would have been and the amount they would have paid. They saved them $10 million on their taxes. Now, here's the thing. The best time to call Sandrowski to set up your business with this particular structure would have been when you formed your business, but you didn't know about it. So I'm telling you about it now. The second best time to call them is right now, because you need at least a 5-year window in order for this specific structure to take place. If you have a business and you're thinking about your exit strategy for a number of reasons, and the qualified small business tax exemption is just one of them, that is a great reason to call Sandrowski Corporate Advisors. You can reach out to them at 866-717-1607, 866-717-1607. We're also brought to you by My Revenue Roadmap Guide. If you're looking to build your book of business, you're a lawyer, you're a CPA, financial advisor, architect, consultant, you want to build your book of business and you like to do that based on relationships, I've got the plan for you. Just go to revenueroadmapguide.com, enter your contact info, download my plan for free. It's the same plan I use with my clients. You can customize it for yourself. It's my gift to you for watching the show on YouTube, for listening to the show, revenueroadmapguide.com. All right, so before we took a break, Neville, I asked you specifically about what to do when creditors call, right? Because you shouldn't ignore those calls. What should you do when creditors call?
Right, and I want to start by saying, by giving the very important part of the statute. If a business person doesn't read any other part of the statute, the bankruptcy code, please read this, that's the part that that addresses involuntary bankruptcy, involuntary section 303. So what you want to do if you're getting calls is keep in mind that if you have more than 12 creditors, then at least three creditors with unsecured aggregate undisputed unsecured debt of at least $16,000 roughly can file an involuntary petition against your company. And that involuntary petition is a request that the federal bankruptcy judge put your company into bankruptcy. Very, very serious. You absolutely want to avoid that. The legal standard for a bankruptcy judge to by law put you in a bankruptcy is number one, are all the creditors qualified? Do they have truly undisputed debts and in the statutory amount of $16,000, and is it unsecured? Usually easy to satisfy. But secondly, the legal standard is the requirement is, is the business generally not paying its debts as they come due? It doesn't have to do with, is the bankruptcy the best disposition of the company? Is the company better off using some other restructuring tool? It's a pretty thin test. And so you want to avoid being in that situation. And so how do you get creditors to not be so frustrated that they want to do that? Now, keep in mind, there are remedies that creditors get overzealous and they put you in and you really shouldn't be, and you can sue them for damages. But by the time you get there, you could have lost your business because you have the harm of a bankruptcy filing, which is available for anyone to see on the internet. So how do you give creditors the kind of attention so that you avoid that kind of scenario? One is just basic stuff we learned in third grade. Someone calls you, call them back. Okay. Be responsive. Call them back on time. Don't call them back a week later. They call that day, then return a call that day. If you can call them, get somebody else to call them. Somebody you trust, somebody who represents you well. You might, and I represent somebody in the business. I suggest that somebody on the business side call them back. Don't have your lawyer call them back. That makes it sound like this is going to be litigation. Get a business person to call them back, and preferably you, because they're investing in you and they trust you. Thirdly, make sure that everything you say to your creditors is honest and transparent. This is not the time to give incomplete information, false information. Of course, you shouldn't do that anyway. But you don't want to shade the truth. Be totally honest, totally transparent. Creditors hate it when they're lied to, and they know when they're lied to. Look, we live in a goldfish economy in any event. It's so easy to get information on almost anything. You shouldn't even pretend that the truth won't come out. So you should do what's right, because doing what's right is truthful is right in any event. But particularly in business, this is definitely the time to be transparent. And then I urge clients to don't overpromise and underperform. That's fatal. One of the first casualties in a financial distress situation, besides accuracy of information, is trust. Typically, the creditors have lost trust either in your ability to tell the truth or your ability to perform. And so you have a hurdle, you have a burden on you that you have to take very seriously. I have to rebuild trust with my creditors. And how I'm going to do that, I'm not only going to return their calls, I'm going to tell them exactly what's going on. I'm going to be flat out honest, and I'm going to give them projections that are conservative, and I'm going to build in milestones for the recovery process that I know I can keep. Do not build in milestones that sound great. So you think the credit will go away. Oh, he's going to earn $1 million next year. When in privately, you know, you're really going to make $250,000. Give them conservative projections that are honest, and then overperform them. Every time you overperform, you build trust. Every time you underperform, you weaken trust. So those are some of the basic tools. Again, a lot of things that we learned from our parents or we learned in third grade, very applicable to the business environment.
I think that's fantastic advice. That's really great. I mean, the way I look at it is, I know you're embarrassed, but this is going to come out eventually. Yeah. So it's going to come out eventually. So let's talk about it now. Let's just get it over with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So now I want to ask you, Neville, about the superpower that bankruptcy lawyers have when they're negotiating with creditors. You know what I'm talking about, right? If you're you could be a litigator, but you're at a bankruptcy firm, or you are a bankruptcy attorney and you litigate sometimes. There's always the ability to put your client into bankruptcy. And my experience from talking to my friends who are bankruptcy lawyers is that's like a superpower, because a creditor knows, they look you up on the firm's website and they know, oh, I'm negotiating with Neville and he hasn't said he's going to put his client into bankruptcy, but he could do it at any time because he's a bankruptcy lawyer. Right. Explain what that means to people.
Yeah. So the bankruptcy filing itself, let's say it's an 11 where you're going to reorganize. It creates automatically what's called a stay, an automatic stay. And an automatic stay is like a big stop sign. It says, all you creditors out there across the country, you have to stop. So all of those rights that you creditors thought you had under your contract to take the company, to break it up, you take your collateral, I take my collateral, blah, 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 that all stops. The economic theory behind it being, of course, that assets are going to create greater value for all the constituents that are involved if they're kept together in a single form, instead of allowing creditors to go to disparate forms across the country, across the world in some situations, and just interfere with the reorganization process. The automatic stay is an enormously powerful tool. If I file and I therefore can stop you from you exercising your remedies, I don't have to ask, I don't have to seek an injunction, I have to go through a test of, oh, is the typical preliminary injunction test, is are you likely to succeed on the merits, yada, yada, yada. It's automatic. Congress put it in there. It's a big stop sign. It's automatic. So that's one of the most powerful tools. Secondly is for roughly an 18-month period, I'm the only person, the debtor, that has exclusive right to file a plan of reorganization. Now, debtors, creditors have they try to interfere with that by saying, oh, you should shorten exclusivity because this debtor doesn't know what they're doing. Very hard for creditors to obtain that kind of relief. Most judges like to give you that 18-month period in which you can file a plan of reorganization. Now, there is a new sub-chapter called Sub-5, which is for smaller cases up to about $7 million of debt. Very, very popular. And that's where a trustee is appointed more as a consultant, but not to run the business. You still run the business, but the trustee is a consultant to the court and to the business saying, hey, let's try to come up with a plan that is consensual that your creditors will agree to. But as a debtor, you have that protection of the bankruptcy judge. And there is an institutional bias for reorganization. So judges like to give debtors a chance. And then the other thing is that let's say there were some transactions that occurred prior to the bankruptcy that were somewhat questionable, that maybe some of the creditors were involved in, one of which is called a fraudulent conveyance doctrine, where transaction with the company occurred and the non-debtor party received a transfer for less than reasonably equivalent value. Let's say they underpaid for some assets. And as a result of that transaction, the debtor was made insolvent. So that's a situation where the debtor has the ability, or the creditors committee sometimes, instead of the debtor pursuing it, to go back and unravel that transaction. Say to the judge, this third party should have been forced to pay more. They underpaid for these assets. And as a result of their underpaying for them, that led to the debtor's insolvency. Very, very powerful tool. Then there's some other theories that are that kind of keep creditors up at night, which is, well, one of which is equitable subordination, where the creditors committee or the debtors may say, you know, Judge, this creditor, I'm just paraphrasing here, this creditor was so incredibly ruthless in looking after only their own interests. And they took so much control of my company that that's what led me into bankruptcy. So Judge, as a result, you should subordinate their claim below the claims of other creditors. This is what happens when creditors get overzealous in trying to interfere too much in the company's operations. That often gets the ear of a judge, and it sure will get the ear of other creditors who said, you know, I'm worse off because of this entity being in bankruptcy because you, creditor, you were overzealous. So I'm going to support a lawsuit to equitably subordinate your claim to the claim of all the creditors. So you don't get paid until all of us get paid. And if we don't get paid in full, that means you get zero. So there are a lot of powers in bankruptcy that the debtor and the creditors committees can use. And if you're in a negotiation prior to bankruptcy and there's some shady conduct that maybe the creditor engaged in, you can say, hey, you know, you don't want this to hit the fan of bankruptcy. It's a high profile matter in and out of court. So you better do a deal with me now.
Who gets paid first? How does the court decide who gets paid first?
Right. So during the case where, let's say it's at 11 and you're administering it, there's a series of claims that are called administrative claims. Those are claims that are needed. Those are claims that are incurred in order to support the business during the case. Vendors who supply a product, post-petition professionals, lawyers, anybody whose claim arises after the bankruptcy case, that's technically considered an administrative claim. I guess a little complicated to the extent that the cash that would be used to pay those claims are encumbered by a lien to secure bank debt, to secure loans that were given to the debtor pre-petition and where the cash and all the receivables were committed as collateral. So what you typically do is you go to your lenders who have a lien on the receivables and on the cash coming in and say, look, we're all going to be better off if the business is alive. Let me pay these expenses that are necessary to run the business. And we will, as a result of doing that, we will replenish the cash post-petition that we are using that is subject to your lien. So you have a lien on this cash, you have lien receivables, fair enough. We're going to use that cash. But as a result of using that cash to pay vendors and to pursue our plan, we're going to create another stream of receivables that will be even greater, or at least it will be no worse than what you have. Greater, and we would use the cash and those receivables to replenish the cash that was ordinarily part of your collateral. And at the end of this, creditor, you're going to be better off because we'll have a going concern business, we'll find a buyer, you get more of your debt paid as opposed to shutting us down now. And then, as you know, Dave, when you shut business down, often people who owe the company money, they say, okay, I'll sit back, you know, come and get me. And then they try to negotiate some discount on the receivable. Receivables always pay more when the business is operating. So to answer your question, who gets paid first? The administrative claims, people who are needed, entities are needed to keep the business afloat, professionals, vendors. And then once you get to the plan stage and you're trying to figure out what the waterfall is of who gets paid first, that'll be determined according to the non-bankruptcy priorities under a state law, and we typically on a state law. So if you're a lien holder, you got a security interest in assets and you were the first to file your uniform commercial code notice, your public notice saying I have a lien, then you'll have a perfected first priority lien in those assets and you'll be entitled to the first payment. And then there'll be junior lien holders who file the liens afterwards. They'll get paid. In some cases, you have situations where some liens weren't properly perfected, so they get avoided, they get wiped out. That's a nightmare. You obviously want to make sure all your paperwork is there. So lien holders first, and then you have in bankruptcy, you have priority unsecured creditors, like say tax claims, employees, wages. The Congress created certain special categories. And then you have your broad class of general unsecured creditors, no lien, no priority created by Congress, but they have a claim for unpaid debt.
That's fantastic. You've given us kind of a class today on bankruptcy. It's been great. Now talk to us about your business development activities, in addition to, you know, getting involved in cases where people will refer you business. What else do you do, Neville, for business development?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I made sure that I did when I became a trustee is I wanted to meet all the other trustees. In Chicago, there are roughly 45 of us. So I always make it my business to really get to know all the other trustees. Some of my best cases have come from representing other trustees, which has been great. And so that's the that's one of the best things I've done. I also have expanded my practice to include what are called receiverships, where I either represent receivers. Now, receivers are people that handle the financial distress situation, but it's not actually in a bankruptcy case. It might be in state court or it might be in federal district court, but not in bankruptcy court itself. But it's the same kind of skill set. And I've had great receivership clients. And then I myself have been appointed a receiver by the SEC in a decent sized case here in Chicago involving a guy who had a Ponzi scheme. And I had to liquidate about $80 million of real estate. So I got my team and I here, we were able to secure that business in part because I was able to really put forward some very important credentials about many years of experience in the trustee community. So we gave that to the SEC and they, as you know, they need to appoint receivers from outside their office. And so we just made ourselves attractive. And so that has worked out very well. Very active in the National Association of Banksy Trustees, which is a national organization that that represents all the trustees in the country. And so I was active in that this past year I was president for the organization, and therefore have broad relationships with trustees across the country. And thankfully, when something's filed here in Chicago and somebody, say, in Missouri is a bankruptcy trustee and they have a client that needs representation, they want to go with somebody that they know. And so I get a lot of referrals from that national network. I also network with other people in my office. Of course, I mean, lawyers got to remember, one of the best sources of your business is the other lawyers in your office who have relationships with clients that already trust the firm, already trust them. And the client just needs to know, hey, if you got a financial distress situation, then we have a bankruptcy group here that can take care of it. So I get a lot of business that way as well. Through groups like Provisors, which has been great, getting to know people, having a monthly opportunity to tell people what you've been doing, what you're working on, latest accomplishments. That's been really good. And I tell my kids this, my wife and I have five kids and, you know, they're now getting into their professions. I tell them, you know, don't pass up the opportunity to get speaking engagements, to develop a national reputation. And I just say, you just don't know when that's going to really come back to benefit you. And I learned that the other day because I was recently inducted into the American College of Bankruptcy.
Oh, congrats. That's great.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much. They're a very selective group. And
yeah, that's terrific.
Thanks. So that's those people who follow your career and you don't quite know that they're looking at you, and you got to be doing this for at least 15 years. And they like what they saw, and they particularly like my leadership in the NEBT, National Association of Bankruptcy Trustees. They told me last October that I will be inducted. I've been selected to be inducted. Only 37 people this past year across the whole country were selected. And that's quite an honor. But things like that, credentials like that, help augment your appeal to people who are looking for assistance in financial distress cases.
Well, that's fantastic. Congratulations. You mentioned five kids. As an attorney, as a bankruptcy lawyer, you're working a lot of hours. How do you balance? Is there balance? How did you raise five kids during that time?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost is my awesome, fabulous wife, Donna Reed. Honey, if you're listening, I not only tell you you're fabulous privately, but I'm telling you now publicly out of here.
You're a very smart man, Neville Reed. You're a very happy wife, happy life. Very smart man.
Could not ask for a better wife. Very understanding, but we really have partnered quite well over the years. Thankfully, you know, you do the best you can for your children. You pray for them and give them good guidance and mentoring. But it's a really beautiful thing when they start making good choices on their own, even when you're not around. The oldest is 31 and the youngest is 20, soon to be 21. And so they're all pretty much in different stages of being on their own. And so my wife and I were pretty close to being empty nesters, and she's a pastor. So we work together on a lot of
Wow, she's problems. Really busy too. Holy cow.
That is. But to answer your question, you know, we just we always we're both very high energy. We love people. We love our children. We love the Lord. And so all those combine to make for a very a happy home. And I'm from a big family. I'm one of six kids. So I've always treasured having a lot of people around. And so I kind of had a sense of what you got to do to kind of make it all click. And so we made sure we were in a nice neighborhood. We love the neighborhood we are in Beverly. My wife got an appointment out to Oak Park, so we're going to be in Oak Park for the time now. So they had also good schools. That helped a lot. You know, a lot of studies show that if you want a child to work out well, give them good peers. I mean, it's helpful, obviously, and important that parents do their best, but your kids got to be around other kids who are really positive, because that's where they're getting a lot of their messaging. And I continue to tell them, I said, I'm so impressed with your guys' friends. I mean, your friends are just great. Your friends could be easily part of our family. They're just, you have very good friends, and that made a big difference. So all those things work together, and got them up on Sunday mornings to get them to church, and that helped a lot, immensely. Yeah. But just give them a lot of love and a lot of guidance. And I'll share this, and this is sort of beyond just business, but sometimes our kids share with us things that they enjoy the most of what we did. And my son told me something the other day. My oldest son, very, very successful, very bright, graduated from Yale, and is now doing both ministry and music. And he said, Dad, one thing that you and Mom did that I always appreciated was that you always asked me for my opinion. And I thought that was interesting, because we often think that kids don't really care or don't know enough to have an opinion, or they get good grades and so forth. But what do they really think about things? And he said, the fact that you asked me those questions about different topics kind of forced me to think. And he's now, what's really beautiful is that now he has really good, well thought out opinions, and I learn from him a lot. So if anyone's listening there and you're raising children, value their opinions and get them to think about ideas.
No, that's fantastic advice. That's really great advice. All right, Neville. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to give you another minute to think, and I want you to give us three things that people should take away from our time together. So come up with three things that we talked about today. Could be across any of the subjects that we talked about. Three things that people should think about. While you're thinking about that, I want to remind you again that Sandrowski Corporate Advisors is the sponsor of our show. And they have a unique focus also on real estate. Believe it or not, Sandrowski Corporate Advisors created a structure for real estate investment trusts a number of years ago. And that structure has become the standard for how real estate investment trusts are treated and how they're handled. It's called the UPREIT structure. And it was invented by Sandrowski, and they can employ this for you on your behalf. What you need to do is you need to reach out to them. The other thing that I love that Sandrowski Corporate Advisors do is they're focused on forensic accounting. So if you have an issue, like some of the issues we've talked about today, and you need somebody to really dive into the numbers and figure out what's going on, like, for example, if you're two partners and you've decided that you're gonna split up and you're gonna go your separate ways. One partner has been handling the books. The other partner was kind of blind to the financials. And the partner who's been handling the books comes to the other partner and says, all right, this is what I'm going to pay you. This is what the buyout is, because this is what the business is worth. And then the first partner says, well, I'd like to look at the books and see. And that he doesn't know what he's looking at. That's a perfect time to reach out to Sandrowski Corporate Advisors and call them. They can look at the books and they can tell you what the business is really worth. They'll do an analysis. They'll look at comparable businesses. They'll look at your cash flow, your assets. They'll give it the full treatment, and you will discover what your business is really worth. Sandrowski Corporate Advisors really is a CPA firm with a different perspective. If you'd like information about any of these things, the forensic accounting or the UPREIT structure or the qualified small business exemption, you got to give them a call, 866-717-1607, 866-717-1607. You can also take advantage of my Revenue Roadmap Guide. It's my gift to you. Go to revenueroadmapguide.com, download your free guide to business development. It's a business development plan. I'm giving it to you because I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you watching. Our guest today is Neville Reed, and he's an excellent, outstanding bankruptcy attorney and trustee in Chicago. If you want to reach out to him, I want you to call 312-224-1245, 312-224-1245. We will also put his email address and the link to his bio page at his firm in the show notes. Do not hesitate to reach out to him if you have any questions about bankruptcy or if creditors are beating down your door, you own a company, and you have had conversations with them, but you're really concerned. Give Neville a call. He can give you some guidance on what you can do. And bankruptcy may not be what you need to do. You heard him say it. He said it here today. He often counsels people not to file for bankruptcy. There are other solutions you can employ, but you got to get the advice first. Anything you tell him, remember, he's a lawyer. Anything you tell him is privileged. He's not going to share it with the general public. Nobody else is going to know. And it's going to be okay. That's the one thing I can tell you. If you get a bankruptcy attorney involved, that's the beginning of things getting better for you. All right, Neville, what are the three things we should take away from our time together today?
Sure. The first I would say is that if you're in financial distress and you're considering bankruptcy, remember that there are a lot of tools available that will enable you to get the benefits of bankruptcy without actually filing for bankruptcy. Very important. Don't rush to bankruptcy. You can get the benefits of bankruptcy without filing for bankruptcy through a lot of tools that we can use to work with you to keep your company out of bankruptcy and to get on a recovery track without going through the potential adverse effects of bankruptcy filing. Secondly is Apollo 13. That's one of my favorite movies. And that movie, if you recall, where Tom Hanks is playing the role of the lead astronaut, that was a flight to the moon that was not successful in the sense that they weren't able to make the landing and had to get back to Earth. And one of the most powerful statements that Tom Hanks says at the end, and I don't know if it's historically correct, but it sure is, I think, helpful, is Apollo 13 was a successful failure, a successful failure. So if you should be in financial distress, and even if bankruptcy is the best tool for you, don't look upon it as a failure to yourself. Personally, look upon it as an opportunity, and as an opportunity to have a successful failure. That is, the business didn't go the way you wanted to, but it is an opportunity for a turnaround and for a fresh start. And then thirdly is third grade. There are so many things that I remember and that I use in my practice that frankly, I learned in third grade. Be honest with people, treat them with respect. Try not to brag and say you're going to be able to do something that you can't. If you're going to say you can do something, then follow through and do it and be responsive. Somebody calls you, return their call, get back to them. Really basic stuff that can help keep you out of trouble.
That's great advice. Thank you, Neville. Our guest today has been Neville Reed. He is a bankruptcy attorney and a trustee in Chicago. If you want to reach out to him, you call 312-224-1245. You can also find his email address and a link to his bio page in the show notes. Neville, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a privilege having you with us.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right, folks, that'll do it for another episode of the Inside BS Show. We will be back here tomorrow with another edition of our show. Until then, I'm Dave Lorenzo, and here's hoping you make a great living and live a great life.